cliffcentral.com.
We got to get Candice Mama in here. I want to talk to her about her book. She's written a book called Forgiveness Redefined, A Young Woman's Journey Towards Forgiving the Apartheid Assassin Who Brutally Murdered Her Father. And she says that she is a forgiveness advocate and a happiness activist. So I think that's
that sounds like the way to go.
Yeah, I like that. I'm going to maybe steal those and put them on my list
on
of
your
things.
Bio.
I'm going to say I'm a happiness activist. How are you, Candice Mama? Good
to
see
you, Gareth Cliff.
By the way, you're looking very glamorous.
Oh, thank you so much. Oh. This is what happens when you get ready at 4 in the morning. I actually don't know what I look like.
Well, I'm so impressed. You look great.
Thank you.
All right, so
listen,
congratulations on the book. The last time I saw you, you were still doing shows here with us.
I was.
You've been busy, huh?
Somewhat. Yeah. I think, you know, once I left here, I was like, what am I going to do with my life, my time? I'm unemployed.
Yeah, I mean,
it's all over.
Yeah, it's right. All over for me.
So I'm amazed. Like, this is a very, very insightful book. And first of all, I mean, I continue to be inspired by people who manage to find a way of making really difficult things in their past an element of how they go forward and what they can do for other people. But you've always been so optimistic, and you know, you really are a bundle of energy. You come in here and you bounce around, you smile, you make everybody happy around you. And just, we've got to go to the start of this story, because I don't think a lot of people even know necessarily what happened when you were a little girl and what happened to your dad.
Yeah.
And maybe we should start with that, because that's where the book begins.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was 7 months, I used to say 9 months, but my maths is really bad. So when I was 7 months, my father was brutally murdered by an apartheid assassin by the name of Eugene de Kock.
Eugene de Kock is famously still in prison in Pretoria.
No, he's actually gone on parole.
Is he on parole?
Yeah.
Oh, yes,
yeah.
Of course. Sorry, that was a while ago. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Right.
And I think he's living on the outskirts of Pretoria somewhere. Yeah, so he murdered my father.
This is the guy who used to run Flukplaas, right?
Yes.
That
yes.
was that farm that the old apartheid government kept, where they would interrogate apartheid activists, and mm-hmm. some of these people would just never be found.
Yes.
They would be buried in shallow graves. Some of them have still never been found.
Mm-hmm.
And they're families that have just never had closure.
Mm.
But you're at 7 months old at this point.
Yeah.
You don't know what's going on.
I mean, there's no comprehension,
sure,
right?
Sure, of course. But your mother...
Yes, yes, the rest of my family. And I think for me, what I wanted to do with the book was not necessarily just focus on, you know, my dad's death, but to show really the impact and the ripple effect that it has on a family when someone gets ripped away in such a brutal way, and how that trauma continues to kind of just ripple through the seams of a family and how they interact with one another and how they interact with life.
Mm. Where do you start, though? Because even though you didn't really know your dad, this effect, as you say, that ripples through the whole family. This is something that you've had to grow up with, that you've had to endure as much as everybody else has.
So
where do you even start to develop? Because I would just be furious and I would just be angry, and I don't know that I'd ever be able to get over that.
Yeah.
How do you feel about where it all starts?
You know, I mean, I was incredibly angry and I was incredibly depressed, and just, you know, I wanted the world to feel what I felt. So I wanted the world to feel this anger and pain and resentment. And I was like, if I can't be happy, why should anyone else be? So that was my state of being for
so
a
like
very long
resentment
time.
Resentment and bitterness.
Absolutely. And,
sure.
And I think for me, what I came to find was, you know, when you go through painful events in life, any sort of event, the world will justify your pain. Like, they'll be like, yeah, you know, you're entitled to feel angry because this is what happened to you. But for me, I had a very awakening moment, if you could say that.
Sure.
I think I was around 16 when I thought I was having a heart attack, went to the hospital, and the doctor pretty much told me my body was killing me. And so
stress.
It was ulcers. It was like depression. He was just like, I don't know what the hell's happening with you, but you're too young to be manifesting these kind of symptoms in your body. And I mean, I was an athlete and I ate relatively well. So I was very confused, but I was never confused about where it came from. I kind of knew that the anger and the resentment was kind of manifesting physically, even though I couldn't scientifically prove it. I just knew that my body was not necessarily keeping up with what was happening in my mind. So for me, I had to decide, what am I going to do?
So that pain and that resentment, that was growing in you and that was manifesting itself physically in these symptoms. So you were getting depressed, but you were also getting ulcers and all these kinds of things. So it actually has... there's a mind-body connection there.
That absolutely. Like if you look at certain cancers, they're created from stressful moments, from shockingly traumatic stressful moments. And it's your cells have a memory, and it actually remembers that trauma, that mental trauma that you've been through.
How do you break out of that, though?
It's not easy. It's, you know, it's, for me, it was a two-part thing. So number one, it was like, do I want to break out of this? Because
For some people, it sustains them. It's all they've got, right? Their pain.
Exactly. And I also thought to myself, like, if I die, would it be that bad? You know, so to me, it wasn't about like, do I want to survive? It was just like, which is kind of the easiest way here. Like, do I just die? And like, you know, and I cease to exist. And, you know, I start over if there's reincarnation, or I just float into the abyss if, you know, there's no other life. Or do I decide to attempt to live? And for me, it was just the wanting to attempt. It was never a full in, I'm going to try and do this. It was just, let me try. Let me see how it would work if I did try to live. And then it became anger at Eugene. So it was kind of like, you know, I'm so angry at him. Why am I letting him control me like this? Like, if him kind of thing. So it didn't necessarily start as forgiveness. It started as like, why am I giving him this power over me? And that's when my journey really started. And I started thinking differently around my situation.
Whose stories gave you some kind of a template in this respect? Because you're a young woman at this stage, 16 years old.
Yeah.
You don't know. You need to find examples of other people who've had to deal with forgiveness, or who've had to deal with letting go of their pain.
Yeah.
Who inspired you at that point?
I mean, luckily living in South Africa, right? There's like just everywhere people are giving you stories of pretty much forgiveness, letting go, moving forward. I mean, Archbishop, former President Nelson Mandela. And so there were so many examples of it. But for me, it didn't necessarily resonate, to be honest, because I thought to myself, like, how? Like, you know, and I genuinely thought like, Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela were like birthed by angels. I was like, I don't have that capacity to forgive. Like, who am I? You know, so it didn't necessarily, I didn't even think about forgiveness. For me, it was just, let me attempt to be happy. Let me start a life where I can feel fulfillment in some sort of way. And let me move in that way. And as I started moving forward, I started thinking, okay, maybe it's not a bad thing if I let go. And for me, letting go meant, let me understand the context of what is happening and what has happened. And for me, that really started my journey to forgiveness.
All right. But then you did something extraordinary, because you wanted to meet Eugene de Kock.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm going to meet this son of a bitch who killed my dad, effectively.
Yeah.
That's horrible. Because you have to face your fears.
Oh, yeah.
Who initiated that?
So that was the National Prosecuting Authorities that actually initiated the meeting. And I have to be honest, like, I mean, I met Eugene, I'm now 28, I met him around 4 years ago, and I never thought this would happen. Like, you know, even when I was 16 and 17 and 18 and I was working through these moments of pain and I was trying to forgive him, I never thought there'd be a face-to-face encounter. I thought, like, you know, I'm just going to forgive him, move on with my life, and that's it. And so when I was forced to face him, that's where the challenge came in. Because it's one thing to say, yeah, I forgive you. It's another thing to sit in front of someone and say, do I forgive you, though? You know, so I was kind of more afraid of my own response to him, you know, and was that going to set me back in what I thought was a progressive journey of healing.
Where does this meeting happen?
So it happened at Kgosi Mampura Prison in Pretoria.
Okay. It's before he was released. So
yes,
you go there, and do you think about what you're gonna wear? I know this sounds ridiculous, but like,
no,
you're gonna face your dad's killer after a life that's been defined by this. You know, you're gonna sit and look at this son of a bitch, but you've got to now, you got to think about what did you consider. Were you on maybe some kind of tranquilizer or something?
I mean, firstly, those are really great questions, because you'd actually, like, I mean, thinking back, I've never even asked myself those questions. Like, what did I think of what I was going to
wear? If they
made
a movie of your life, you know, this would be a scene in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people would go, what should we make her wear? What
Well, there's a picture of what I was wearing, and it looked awful. So clearly I didn't think of what I was going to wear. If I knew, I would have dressed better. But no, I wasn't on anything. But I think there was this odd calmness. There was like a, because I don't think I fully comprehended what was going to happen, you know? So my body kind of just went into like this autopilot mode and just going through the motions of what was happening. And I mean, I come from a family who I speak about in my book where we don't speak about emotions. Emotions aren't a thing in my family, you know? We would rather have a root canal treatment without anesthetic than speak about emotions, right? So we make light of everything. And so like all of us are like, yeah, I'm not going to be the first one to crack kind of thing. And so we didn't really comprehend it until actually the moment just before we saw him. So I think that's when it really hit me. Like when we were all sitting down, you know, we'd had coffee because they were briefing us on what was going to happen.
How many of you are there?
So it was myself, my older brother, my younger brother from my stepdad, and my mom and my grandfather, my dad's dad. Yeah. Wow. So yeah, so it was us, and then there were other people from the prison, you know, the priest and the warden of the prison. And
okay, so the door goes clang and someone walks through?
No, so it wasn't actually, it was actually like, because I was expecting that. I thought I was going to see like a proper prison inside, nothing like that. It was actually like you're visiting someone, like you're visiting like an old relative or something with a long dining room table and like this odd urn in the corner with biscuits. It was like a very odd setup, which I think added to the eerie feeling, because you're kind of like, what is happening? Like, I'm not visiting family here, you know? So you kind of get that feeling. But then there's like a door, there are two separate doors. And I thought like, you know, I don't know what I expected. Like, you know, what does one expect when you go and meet someone who's responsible for so many deaths and murders? And so I was like, okay, obviously.
Did they let you choose? Do you want to go behind door number one or door number two?
I wish they had. I wish they had. No. So for us, they were like, oh, he's going to walk in at any minute, you know, and it will take off. But if you ever feel uncomfortable, blah, blah, blah. So when they said that, I thought they were still going to introduce him. Like, yeah. Hey, guys, Eugene's walking in now. Like, you know, don't be alarmed. No, they didn't do that. So like, I think because he was the closest to me. And I turned around first and he was just sitting there like he had just appeared like a ghost.
Oh my word.
And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. How did he, is there like a locked door at the bottom of the floor? And he just like,
but you
rises.
Knew what he looked like from pictures and things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And he did not, like, he didn't look any different. It's like prison preserved him. It was the oddest sight. Yeah, so he was just sitting there. He had, they'd taken off his like cuffs and stuff. And he was obviously in this orange jumpsuit with his glasses. And so when I saw him, the priest who was sitting next to me was like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe I should say something. I was like, maybe you should. And then he started introducing Eugene and, you know, to each and every one of us. And he was like, you know, that's Sandra Mama, wife of the deceased Glenok Masilo Mama, and then my grandfather, blah, blah, blah. And he introduced us individually. And with each one of us, Eugene would lean forward and say, pleasure to meet you, then sit back. Pleasure to meet you, then sit back. And, you know, so it kind of went like that. And I mean, it was still very uncomfortable.
Jeez.
Like, I don't think I took a breath once during that like initial greeting.
Was it just your family that he did this with? Did he do it with all of the families?
No, so it was actually a victim perpetrator dialogue. So apparently they'd been looking for the different families, you know, who, like, I mean, I don't know how they were going to find all, you know, 212 victims, or, but they were looking for families and they were doing these dialogues. So I think they'd met, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was like over 20 families at that time. And we were like coming towards the end, the close of it, because apparently they couldn't find us, which is weird because my mom was so active on Facebook. So they clearly weren't looking, but yeah.
So for him, it had become a little bit routine by this stage.
Yeah, I would assume so. And I think, I mean, it was a meeting that, you know, you expect an outcome from, I think, in some ways. You expect him to be a certain way. And I think for me, maybe it came from practice. I don't know. But he wasn't what I had expected him to be, you know, which
explain that to me, because what was he like then? Now, this is a guy who's got to try and apologize to you.
Yeah.
And to try and carry across with some sincerity the fact that he ruined all of your lives.
Yeah, pretty much. And so for me, I wasn't expecting, I don't want to say warmth, because there was still a coldness in the room, but there was definitely, I don't know, like a palpable, like, you know, you could feel kind of the remorse he was feeling, you know. It was like he really wanted us to get as much closure as possible, and he understood that there's nothing he can do really, right? Like, unless he could resurrect my dad, there's really nothing he can do for us. And so he was trying so hard to, like, almost, and he had, like, he has a photographic memory, and so he just knew every single detail. He knew exactly my dad's case. He knew exactly what happened. He, like, retold that story as if it happened yesterday.
Well, he must have been going through it in his head for years in jail. He's had nothing else to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Did it make you feel, when you walked out, exhausted? Or
uplifted?
Yeah. Did you feel a little bit lighter, or did you just feel drained?
Oh, I felt completely conflicted, actually, because in that moment, so the encounter comes to conclusion and it ends. And so I stand up first, and it was so emotional because I'd already been crying and, you know, and from what he had told me about his life. And so I get up first and I go to him and I'm like, would you mind if I gave you a hug? And so I hug this man, and then he says to me, I'm so sorry for what I've done, and your father would have been so proud of the woman you've become. And I'm like, Oh, Jesus. So, I mean, I was just like, what is happening? What is happening right now? And so I felt the sadness for him, because I was like, there's nothing. Like, even if I say I forgive you, there's nothing that can remotely affect your life from this point forward. No, you know,
like, life's horrible. What life? I mean,
there is no life, right?
There's no life left there.
And so for me, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, like, am I betraying my dad's memory, or am I, you know, like, I was a little conflicted, like, driving back home. Like, I just embraced the guy who killed my dad. You know, how does this work? You know, and so I felt.
But there's no right or wrong at that moment, right?
Yeah.
It's only what you, Candace, feel. And, you can respond whichever way you like, and it's right.
Absolutely.
It's
absolutely.
Just unbelievable.
Yeah.
So what I love about the book is you kind of. It's your story, but you're also. There are lots of things in here that are useful tips for people who are struggling to forgive and to move on. And to relinquish that feeling of being a prisoner of your own pain. And I think that's really beautiful. Is that one of the purposes you had in mind when you wrote it?
Wow, that makes
me happy.
Not
just telling your story. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes me really happy to hear. Yeah, you know, a big part, like, I had no intention of, you know, doing this as a career, speaking about forgiveness, writing a book about it. And I think for me, once I began sharing my story, you know, it started these small, like, you know, or crowds. And every single time I tell my story, like, no less than 5 people would come up to me and reveal, like, some of the deepest, darkest, you know, secrets and say, I've never told anyone. And you sharing your story gives me the power to share my own. And I was like, oh, you know, so many people need healing, but how do I do it in a way that I don't physically necessarily have to be there, but they can have something that is, you know, my story, and that can give them guidance and help just by reading what I've been through.
I mean, you've been so honest about it. So here we go. First thing you do when you find out that your body's really not responding well to you, and you're sending yourself to an early grave.
Yeah.
You list the pros and cons of living and dying. I mean, I love this because this is what a lot of people think in their heads.
That's what people actually do.
Right. So she goes, well, pros, I won't feel pain anymore.
Yeah.
I won't exist. I'll finally know the meaning of life. I can float around haunting people. I'll find out if there's a heaven or a hell. Wait a minute. Do I go to hell if I just let myself die? Or is it only when I kill myself? And does hell exist if you don't believe in Christianity? And finally, you're losing track. Focus. Then she lists the cons. Like, if she kills herself, she'll stop existing. She'll never know love. She'll never have children. She'll never see the world. My brothers and family will miss me. The thing is, death messes up the people left behind more than me. If I move on and go to another plane or just disappear, will it change my family, possibly for the worst? Who will be the mediator? And if I die, I would never have experienced happiness. Oof. So you list these things, and turns out they're more cons than pros.
Here I am.
And you decided to stay alive. No, I mean, you know, this is a hard thing to write
but
down.
But also, for someone you mentioned a little bit earlier, that emotion is not dealt with in a regular manner in your family.
Yeah.
For someone coming from that, you seem very in touch with your emotions, and the way you're able to explain them is extraordinary.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And I think I've probably, the same way I understood that when I was angry, I had this aura that I wanted to hurt other people, is the same way when I found joy and happiness. It's the same thing. I was just like, I'm responsible for the energy I bring into a room. I'm responsible for how I leave people. And I can't, I can't control how people react to me, but I can control, like, am I bringing joy into a space? Am I giving people a platform to be open? And for me, the only way I could do that was to be honest with myself about how I was feeling, and to be, honest and authentic with people about their own emotions and feelings. So, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, I'm blown away by the story. And I just, having known you before as well, before you'd written the book, and having known your story a little bit, it's quite harrowing to read it in your own language. But not, by no means is this a hard, horrible, heavy book. It's actually quite, no, it's happy and it's uplifting, and it's exactly what I think you intended it to be, which is inspiring to people.
Oh, good. That makes me really happy.
So do you go around and talk to people about this story of yours and give them some ideas?
Absolutely.
Give them some tips.
Yeah. So I have somehow managed to live a career, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
But live a career in where I help people overcome their own trauma, So for example, I was in Australia a couple of months ago, and I'd worked with this organization. It's a mentorship program, and they were teaching the forgiveness thing that I'd documented for them to kids who were transitioning. And they surprised me when I got there with all these kids' stories about how this, my story had allowed them to forgive their dad, their mom, someone who'd abused them, sexually molested them, all these things. And they made it into this beautiful montage where they all wrote me a letter and they read it out on camera. And I think it's moments like that where I'm like, oh,
wow.
I'm so glad that this is, helping someone, that from my pain, someone else can also heal,
Well, the book is called Forgiveness Redefined, and Candace Mama wrote it, and she's going to tell you the story, but you've got to go and buy the book.
Thank
you. She's
not
coming to just speak to you for free. buy the book. She went to a lot of trouble to write this, and the least you could do is go and buy a copy for the sake, right?
For me, I think the happiest thing, from this whole interview, is the fact that you told people it's not depressing.
No, it's not depressing.
Because I think a lot of people, people will write to me and say, I cried. And then, people are like, I can't read your book. I love you. I want to support you, but I don't want to be depressed.
And Candace, you've got a story. It's a real story. Some people who have written books, you think, well, what have you ever really experienced? And this is a great journey. So it's beautiful. Well done.
Thank you, Gareth. I really appreciate it.
And it's good to see you again.
It's so good to see you. And thank you so much.
Come and see us some more.
Oh my gosh, this is like my home. I miss it.
Like there's still some of your stuff lying around here.
I want to steal that new little gadget there.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, go and get your stuff. It's probably in one of the boxes here. I'm looking at it. It's like a pair of boots. I think there's an old bra there as well. Is that not yours?
I always knew I'd come back.
All right. Well done on the book. It is called Forgiveness Redefined. CliffCentral.com.